I'm Meghna Chakrabarty in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, the Obama administration is appointing a new cybersecurity czar to guard against attacks on government and private computer networks. But we want to spend a few minutes on an old threat, Osama bin Laden. In December 2001, the al-Qaeda leader escaped the U.S. military in the siege of Tora Bora in Afghanistan, and much has been written about how that happened, but now journalist Peter Bergen has reconstructed what may be the definitive account of what he calls one of the greatest military blunders in recent U.S. history. His article appears in the current edition of The New Republic, and Peter, you've talked to intelligence officers and members of the military who say that at the height of the siege, U.S. forces were able to pinpoint bin Laden's location to within 10 meters. They asked for 800 elite Army Rangers to pursue him, and yet bin Laden got away. So what happened?
Well, it was a comedy of errors. You know, there is just overwhelming evidence now that bin Laden was there, not only from his own account of what happened there, but also from al-Qaeda insiders, Guantanamo detainees, CIA officials, three of them that I spoke to, who said there were multiple intercepts of bin Laden's voice at the battle. And so this is one of these great missed opportunities. And I think one of the reasons for that was an aversion to casualties that the U.S. military had at the time. There was also a concern that a heavy footprint of U.S. forces would alienate the Afghans. There was also, to be honest, I think a distraction by Iraq. I mean, General Tommy Franks, in his autobiography, he outlines the fact that in early December, when all this was going down, he was being asked by Donald Rumsfeld to revamp the Iraq war plan. Well, revamping a war plan is not something you do on the back of an envelope. I mean, I think that, in a sense, the Pentagon was a victim of its own success. It looked like, you know, everything had been taken care of. Well, it hadn't. And, you know, in the 2004 election campaign, this became an issue. John Kerry pushed the issue pretty hard, saying an opportunity had been lost. And, in fact, both the President Bush and Vice President Cheney and Tommy Franks all publicly said in the run-up to a very close election that John Kerry was wrong, that bin Laden, you know, there was no evidence or little evidence that bin Laden was at Tora Bora. Well, in fact, John Kerry was completely correct.
And in fact, the people that you've spoken with for this article confirm that. I mean, you've even got Osama bin Laden's son, Omar, telling you that they regularly sort of planned escape routes out of Tora Bora, to the point that Osama bin Laden was telling his sons, memorize every stone and rock on the path to Pakistan.
Well, and it's not just Omar bin Laden. Five Guantanamo detainees specifically talk about seeing bin Laden at Tora Bora. One of his chief bodyguards describes how bin Laden escaped from Tora Bora. I mean, the evidence is there's not just sort of a couple of data points. There's a sort of avalanche of evidence he was there. Certainly, Delta operators on the ground felt that, you know, a Ranger battalion up to 800 men might have done the job. And by my calculation, there were more journalists at the Battle of Tora Bora than there were American soldiers. There were about 100 journalists and about 60, 70 American soldiers and CIA officials. You know, if CNN can get its correspondents and producers and camera people to Tora Bora, why can't the U.S. military?
We should keep in mind that the CIA had two teams, at least, in Tora Bora. They had made a very straightforward request for a mere 800 troops. That request was never granted, and yet you say at the end of the day, one of the lessons learned is that nothing replaces boots on the ground.
You know, I agree. I mean, things have changed a little bit in the sense that there is the American drone program, which is much more sophisticated than it would have been in 2001. But, you know, the way to guarantee success is to put boots on the ground. And I'm not privy to any, you know, classified information, but I mean, I'm sure there is a game plan in place to send American special forces into Pakistan if you have very good information about the location of bin Laden, Ayman al-Zawahiri, his number two, Mullah Omar. And, you know, at the end of the day, you really need people on the ground.
Is there anything that you uncovered in terms of this sort of cascade of setbacks in this two-week period in December where the siege of Tora Bora was taking place that surprised you?
Well, look, I mean, I think one thing that was surprising was the fact that bin Laden almost died at the Battle of Tora Bora. I mean, he was very shaken by the whole experience. He released a videotape 2 weeks afterwards in which he didn't move his left shoulder, his left side, implying very strongly that he was wounded. The American bombs that dropped on Tora Bora were massive, and they did do some damage to al-Qaeda, but it wasn't enough. You have to secure the actual ground with boots on the ground. But the point is that certain people make a difference. I think we might be in a very different situation in Afghanistan and Pakistan if al-Qaeda had been basically destroyed at the Battle of Tora Bora. We might be in a, might have been in a very different situation in Iraq, where al-Qaeda played a pretty horrific role providing most of the suicide bombers. And so, you know, it's one of history's great what-ifs.
Peter Bergen's article revealing untold detail about the Battle of Tora Bora appears in the current issue of The New Republic. He is also a senior fellow at the New America Foundation in Washington, D.C., where he co-directs the Counterterrorism Strategy Initiative. Peter Bergen, thank you so much.
Okay, Magna, thank you.
Well, that was 2001, but today, as President Obama sends thousands of additional troops to Afghanistan, we're going to spend a few minutes with someone who's used to multiple deployments.
I've been an Army wife for 6.5 years. By my calculations, my husband has been deployed or away for training for about 50 of the 80 months we've been married.
That's Rebecca Sanderlin. She writes about family life inside the military in her blog, Operation Marriage. She writes for the Fayetteville Observer, and military life is one she knows well. Rebecca's husband has served 3 tours in Afghanistan.
During those away months, I've given birth to and cared for 2 children on my own through all sorts of infant and childhood maladies. I've cared for and buried my father without the benefit of a spouse to lean on. I've attended countless memorial services for friends of ours who didn't make it home from war, and I've comforted their widows. Most days, there are no adults in my house at the end of the day to remind me that there is life outside of Dora the Explorer. This blog has been my lifeline.
Rebecca Sanderlin joins us from the studios of WFSS in Fayetteville, North Carolina, and we should say her husband is back at home now. But Rebecca, can you just take us back to the beginning and tell us how you got started writing the blog?
I worked full-time as a reporter for the Fayetteville Observer, and then I had my oldest child, my son Beau, who is now 5. And when Beau was born, my husband was getting ready to go to Afghanistan the first time, and he left. I guess Beau was 2 weeks old when he left. So I quickly realized that I wouldn't be going back to work. And then after about a year, the editor at the paper had this idea for starting blogs, and they wanted me to write a blog for military families. So they asked, and I did it, and it's taken off and been great.
And I can imagine one of the reasons why it's taken off is because I'm sure it speaks to the experiences of many people that you know and many families across the country. But for you in particular, after the blog got started, did you find that it helped deal with your frustrations when you were writing it or not?
At first, I wanted to put forth the stiff upper lip, inspiring military wife front. But, you know, life started wearing me down, too, just like all the other military wives out there. So after a while, I decided to just be honest and talk about the things that I know other people are also experiencing.
And those other people, those other military families, have they commented? Have they written to you? Do you sense a community forming around your blog?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I started really getting emotionally honest about a year and a half ago when my dad was dying and my husband was deployed and I was pregnant. And, you know, it just seemed like the world was crashing down around me. And so I wrote about that, and that's when I started really getting just amazing responses from people, you know, wonderful emails and comments and very supportive comments.
Your husband, who's served in Afghanistan for 3 tours, he's back now, and I understand that you don't want to name him. Can you tell us why?
I throw myself out there. I'm a fairly public person. I've never been shy or quiet. He's a little more embarrassed when people say, I heard what your wife said or I read what your wife wrote. So just to kind of help him maintain a little bit of privacy, I try to keep him out of it, and he appreciates that.
Well, Rebecca, you and your husband and your kids live in a military community with Fort Bragg and Pope Air Force Base right near you. So how is that reflected in your blog?
Fayetteville is Fort Bragg. There's very little separation, and there's probably nobody in Fayetteville who doesn't have some connection to the military, whether it's a relative in the military or veteran or retiree, or, you know, so we're absolutely completely inundated with military here. So that's definitely going to come out in the things that I write.
And we've been at war. The country's been at war for more than 8 years now, and that's obviously had an effect, particularly regarding casualties. But also there's a toll, which I know you've written about, that you can't really sort of see firsthand. Can you describe how ongoing war has taken a toll on the community?
My personal experience with myself and my friends is the effect that all the deployments have had on families. You know, families are falling apart. I can't even sugarcoat that. The actual statistics don't reflect this, but I know so many people whose marriages have failed just in the last maybe 2 years. And then so many of my friends whose children are struggling in school because of behavioral problems that are related to deployments, to stress, and then beyond that, there's the ancillary issues that are not big deals, but cumulatively, they all add up. Like little league teams that don't have coaches, and there are animal shelters that are overrun with pets because nobody had anyone to watch them while they were deployed, and altogether, just this overburdening of a community because of all these deployments.
So it's hard to escape the absence of all the members of the family and the military members who aren't at home.
Fort Bragg is such a huge component of Fayetteville that when a large brigade is deployed, you see the absence. You know, all of a sudden, there are not as many people here, and it's very noticeable. You know, you go to the post office and you see moms juggling two infants trying to send a care package to Afghanistan, and there's a line of them like that. You know, there might be 20 or 30 moms at any point in time at the Fort Bragg post office. You can't help but see the deployment here.
You know, earlier you mentioned that when you started writing the blog, you wanted to maintain that classic stiff upper lip, the strong and surviving military wife sense. But you've also, on the other hand, you've been really honest about the problems in your marriage. And, you know, as you just said, that marriages surrounding you are really being strained. So has writing about your marriage in particular, has that helped?
I think it's helped me. I hear from people who seem to appreciate that somebody else is going through the same thing they're going through. And so I think that there is, you know, some value to people who are struggling through similar situations to be able to get on the internet and find other people in the same situation. And, you know, it doesn't provide an answer or a solution, or it doesn't make the day easier necessarily, but it at least lets you know you're not alone.
And you said that one of the times where all this sort of really hit home for you, in fact, in that reading that we heard earlier, was when your father died. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, he was, honestly, there was like a 2-week period where I found out that I was pregnant. I found out my husband was going back to Afghanistan. He'd only been home for 5 months. And then I found out in that same 2 weeks that my dad, who I'd just seen and who seemed very healthy, had stage 4 esophageal cancer and wasn't expected to live longer than 6 months. And, it was just absolutely the most devastating 2 weeks of my life. My husband was getting ready to go to Afghanistan, so we had to go into survival mode and just get everything together and get him packed and out the door. And then as soon as he left for Afghanistan, then I packed up the house and my son and the dog and moved back to Tennessee where my family lives so that I could move in with my dad and take care of him until he died. And so it was just this very, very hard. It was just very trying experience because I was getting bigger and bigger and bigger pregnant and trying to nurse a grown man and take care of a 3-year-old. And I guess that's when I really reached out to the blogging world because I needed people who weren't, you know, my siblings couldn't provide a lot of support because they were right there with me and needed their own support. But the greater community of people that I don't really know, I suppose, really stepped up for me. And that's when I got more honest with the blog.
That's Rebecca Sanderlin. She writes about life for military families in her blog, Operation Marriage, for the Fayetteville Observer. We'll have much more with Rebecca after a break. And later in the show, the upswing of food stamp use in the United States. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back to our conversation with Rebecca Sanderlin. She writes the Operation Marriage blog for the Fayetteville Observer. There's a link on our website, hereandnow.org. And Rebecca, as we said, your husband is home now, but he's served 3 tours in Afghanistan. And you write about the toll those deployments have taken on your marriage, so much so that during his most recent deployment, there was a point where you sort of ran out of compassion for what he was going through in Afghanistan.
Yeah, he was going through horrible experiences. And, you know, we talked on the phone almost every day, and he would tell me what he was going through. And I finally just begged him to stop because I couldn't deal with it. You know, I was already terrified that I was going to have to bury him, you know, the same year that I buried my father. And, you know, he had so many deaths and injuries and everything that was happening around him that I just couldn't deal with it anymore. And so I asked him to stop telling me. And then that caused major problems for us down the road in our marriage because we grew apart.
Was there a moment where you told him that you couldn't listen anymore, where you just felt like you were failing in your duty as a military wife?
Oh, absolutely. Because the Army is always telling us that it's our role as spouses to stay strong and optimistic and to be that support system for the deployed spouse so that they can focus on their job. And, you know, we get it hammered into us that this is our part in the war, you know, that this is what we're doing for the war effort is being a good wife, you know, and being supportive. And when I realized that I couldn't do that, I felt horrible because I felt like I was being a bad wife. I also felt like my husband was in this, I mean, he was in hell. And I couldn't even do what little bit I should have done to help him. And he understood that. But, you know, yeah, I felt just tremendous guilt over that.
Well, you've also written that, you know that you and your husband are ultimately responsible for things that work and haven't worked in your marriage. But it's not as if that you're living an average American experience. I mean, your husband's in the military. He's been to Afghanistan multiple times. And so there's that third party that you talk about that's in the marriage, and that third party being the military itself.
The joke among military wives, pretty common joke, is that the military is actually the first wife and the wife is second wife. The military comes first, you know. Nobody wants it to be that way for sure. But, you know, there are so many aspects of our life that we don't get to control that in a normal marriage you would at least have some say in, like where you live or when you move or where your kids go to school or, you know, whether or not you're going to see your husband at all this year. You know, and when you're in a military family, you don't get a say in any of that. So in a lot of ways, you know, as a wife, you're secondary. You're having to deal with all kinds of people's opinions.
Well, about your the other members of your family, your two really beautiful children, you've got a son, Beau, and a daughter, Rudy. They're still pretty young, aren't they?
Yeah, Beau is 5, and Rudy just turned 1 a couple of months ago.
So they haven't known life without a father who's going back and forth between war and home.
No, and Beau is getting old enough now to, you know, really ask questions. And when we go visit my sisters and brother, and Beau sees that his cousin's daddies don't go off, he's very confused by that. And he doesn't understand why it is that his daddy's always going and these other daddies don't ever seem to go anywhere. That's very strange to him because, you know, living again in Fayetteville where, I mean, every kid in his class's dad is in the Army, he thinks that this is normal. So when we go outside of Fayetteville, he sees that everybody else has a different life, and it's very confusing for him.
And I know that you know there's been lots of studies and reporting about children who are struggling with parents who have multiple deployments overseas. Are your children struggling, do you think?
Well, Rudy is too young. She's a baby, so it doesn't really affect her too much yet. But yeah, we've had a lot of behavioral problems with Beau. He's getting, especially when he was about 3 and he wasn't vocalizing very well, he would get very frustrated and very emotional but not know how to express that. And so he'd get violent, you know, wouldn't obey his teachers. And so we had a lot of behavioral problems with him then. At one point, he was pretty much kicked out of a preschool. And, they didn't, I guess, actually kick us out, but they didn't try to keep us there either. So he was going through all of these behavioral problems. And then I had all of these other things, you know, with my husband deployed, my dad dying, you know, about to have Rudy. Everything hit at once.
Do you think there's the possibility now that President Obama has said he wants to send another 30,000 troops to Afghanistan, is there a possibility that your husband may be deployed again?
Well, sure, yeah. I mean, I think there's probably a likelihood that he will be.
And if he is, you've written that your dog, Hank, knows that the deployment's coming.
Yeah, about a week before deployment, Hank starts figuring out that, you know, he starts seeing the bags get packed, and he senses the energy in the air, and he starts getting really mopey. And then it's the saddest thing you've ever seen when the deployment actually takes place, because Hank will sit in front of the door and just whine for like 3 days.
Does he ever snap out of it, or is he kind of a different dog the whole time your husband's gone?
He pretty much snaps out of it after a week or so. And then, but the funny thing is during the deployment, I have to spell out words like D-A-D-D-Y, because if I say it, Hank will run to the door and start barking, thinking that he's home.
And when your husband actually does come home, how does Hank greet him?
Oh, he goes nuts. Hank is about a 110-pound yellow lab, and if you've seen Marley and Me, he looks and acts exactly like that dog. And so when my husband does come home, Hank literally jumps up in the air, like 6 feet into the air, and does these weird body contortions where he's like twisting. It's really cool to watch, but, you know, a lot of things get broken.
Rebecca Sanderlin is a mother, a wife, and a blogger. She writes the Operation Marriage blog for the Fayetteville Observer in Fayetteville, North Carolina. We will link to it at our website, hereandnow.org. And when you're at our website, you can also see a picture of Hank, the 110-pound exuberant yellow lab. He's the Sanderlin family dog. Rebecca, thank you so much for being here with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll take a listen to a high school madrigal group as they prepare for their busiest week of the year.
Deck the hall with boughs of holly, fa-la-la-la-la, fa-la-la-la, 'tis the season.
A little music from the Belmont, Massachusetts High School Madrigal Group tomorrow. The news is up next, Here and Now. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. iPods, iPhones, iTunes. Apple and company co-founder Steve Jobs have revolutionized cell phones, music players, and the music industry itself. And now, Apple has its sights set on television. The Wall Street Journal reports that Apple has floated proposals to various TV networks. They hope to form partnership deals that would offer consumers an alternative to what they're currently getting from cable or satellite TV. And some networks are intrigued. Joining us now is Wall Street Journal reporter Sam Schechner. And Sam, you write that this is all part of a massive overhaul of iTunes. So what might the consumer be faced with if Apple is indeed successful with this expansion into network television?
Well, that's actually unclear. Apple's very secretive about how they are changing things and what it will look like. They're working on a revamp of iTunes that involves the music side of it, and it seems clear from their approaches to TV networks and from what they've told the media companies that they want to have a lot more TV content on there, and the way that they aim to do that is to bundle together a bunch of networks and offer a big swath of the programming in each of those networks through their iTunes store to consumers, kind of in an on-demand format. And that, in essence, replicates some of what cable and satellite operators do, with an important distinction that could upset the whole economics of the TV business. It seems likely that Apple would offer fewer networks than you're obliged to buy when you buy cable service. And, you know, that sort of could put the TV industry on the road to selling smaller packages for less money.
So instead of having a cable subscription with 289 channels, you might get an iTunes subscription with half a dozen TV networks.
Exactly.
So let me ask you, I mean, I'm sure that TV networks out there are hungry for any new platform that they can find. So who is it that Apple has approached, and who out there is interested?
Well, they've approached pretty much everyone. The people who are most interested are at the broadcast TV networks, which are themselves supported almost exclusively by advertising right now, and they're very interested in finding other streams of revenue. Walt Disney Company, which owns ABC, and CBS Corp, which owns its eponymous network, are both at least considering participating in this service.
And you say that that's not terribly surprising because Apple co-founder Steve Jobs actually is a huge shareholder in the Walt Disney Company.
He's the largest individual shareholder, yeah, and the director of the company. And Disney has been, you know, perhaps for that and perhaps also because of the way the company is run, they've been the most aggressive of the major networks and first to put video online and, you know, first into the iTunes store.
So do you have a sense as to how the deal would work between Apple and the networks or the television companies that they'd partner with?
Early versions of the proposal involved them paying, you know, a wholesale price to the networks per subscriber per month, very similarly to the way cable and satellite operators do. It would be about $1 to $2 a month for a basic cable network, and between $2 and $3 or maybe even $4 a month for a broadcast network. And those fees generally depend. Some cable networks have really astronomical fees, like ESPN, but generally those fees are a lot higher than the companies would receive through traditional distributors.
So Apple is trying to woo these networks by maybe offering them a higher rate than they currently get from cable companies. But on the flip side, how much would it cost, you know, users who launch iTunes and maybe want to take a look at this new stream of network programming?
an early version of the proposal was that there'd be, you know, 15 or more networks for $30 a month, or as many as 30 networks for that price. I think that that's all in flux right now as Apple tries to woo more networks. Already, for $1.99 or $2.99, you can watch an episode of 30 Rock, or you can spend almost $70 for a full season of Lost. That's a lot of money to spend, and Apple would like to broaden that market.
Those, if I understand correctly, they don't have commercials in them. So is there a sense that this new, you know, network stream would also be commercial-free?
The initial Apple proposals were that it would be commercial-free, and that is a concern for some media companies. Even cable networks, which get nice subscription fees, most of them sell ads, and that's a significant source of revenue. So the higher prices could offset that lack of advertising, but then it makes it a less attractive proposition if it's going to cannibalize the existing business.
Sam Schechner reports for The Wall Street Journal, and he reported today on Apple's revamp of iTunes and an expansion potentially into network television. Sam, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Up next, half of American children depend on food stamps at some point in their lives, but why? Back in 30 seconds, here and now. Welcome back. The Washington Post reports today that unemployment funds in 40 states could go broke in the next 2 years. That leaves states with two choices: cut benefits or raise taxes. Some states may end up doing both. Meanwhile, a report on another safety net, food stamps, shows that half of all children in the U.S. at some point depended on food stamps. Mark Rank is a professor of social welfare at Washington University in St. Louis, and he's co-author of the study. Professor Rank, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be on.
50% is a shocking number. I mean, half of American children depending on food stamps. Exactly amongst these children, who are we talking about here?
Although we find that half of all kids wind up in a household using food stamps, some kids have a much greater risk of winding up using food stamps. We found that while 37% of white kids will use food stamps at some point during childhood, the percentage for black kids is 90%. We also looked at if a child was in a single-parent family versus a married couple family, and there you find about the same difference, that about 91% of kids in single-parent families wind up at some point using food stamps versus around 37% of kids in married couple families.
Is this a recent phenomenon, or is it something that's been going on sort of under the radar in the United States for a long time?
Well, you know, I've been doing a lot of work over the last 10 or so years in looking at this question of what's the likelihood or the risk of Americans experiencing poverty. And actually, this study is very consistent with what we found in other studies. For example, between the ages of 20 and 75, nearly 60% of Americans at some point will experience a year below the poverty line, and nearly three-quarters of Americans will experience a year of poverty or near poverty. Now, people say, you know, how can these numbers be so high? And the reason is, when you look over longer periods of time, things happen to people that they didn't anticipate. So things like losing a job or getting sick or family splitting up. And when those things happen, in the United States, there's not a whole lot of protection out there to prevent families from falling into poverty.
So it seems like what you're saying is that this isn't necessarily a permanent childhood underclass we're talking about. You know, it's people, your neighbors on the street who may need temporary help for a period of a few months, a few years.
That's exactly right. And for example, what's going on right now in terms of the economic recession, we're seeing a lot of families that are having to turn to food stamps right now during these tough times. But they'll probably use the program for a fairly short period of time until they can get back on their feet. A lot of people think that most people on poverty are there for year in and year out, and actually that's not the typical pattern.
I suppose that raises another question of the fact that while you say that 50% of children at some time in their lives require food stamps in order to get enough to eat, we're not talking about 50% of American kids today, right now, are on food stamps.
That's exactly right. And this work is unusual in that we're looking across 20 years of data in terms of children's lives. And as you look over longer periods of time, you find that risks increase. It's the same thing as saying, what's the likelihood or the risk of developing heart disease? Well, if you look over a long period of time, you're going to find that a pretty significant percentage of the population at some point is going to develop heart disease. The same thing is true in the United States in terms of families experiencing poverty.
If you're talking about temporary need that the government is able to fulfill when people sort of are in dire circumstances because, as you said, of job loss, divorce, the economy, whatnot, isn't this potentially a success story for the food stamp program, that the government is able to fulfill the needs of children in particular when they need it?
In some sense it is, although if you talk to people that receive food stamps, almost all of them will tell you that the assistance is not nearly enough. So most families receiving food stamps run out by the end of the third week. They have to turn to food pantries or some other kind of emergency assistance.
And from what I understand, eligibility for food stamps is a family of four earning $22,000 or less. They're eligible for some $200+ of food stamp assistance every month.
The other thing is you have to have generally below $2,000 or $3,000 worth of assets. So you can't have a lot of money in a banking account or a savings account or something like that. So you have to be both asset poor and income poor in order to receive the program.
There's a criteria for eligibility, Professor Rank, but is everyone who's eligible for food stamps actually getting them?
No, and that's a really important point. So it's estimated that approximately only 65% of people who qualify for the program actually receive it. So in some way, our numbers are an underestimate of the actual amount of need that's out there.
You write that the situation with so many children in need of food stamps at some time is a serious threat to the overall health and well-being of those children. And what exactly is the threat here that you're talking about?
Well, families that are receiving food stamps, approximately half of those families at any point in time are also encountering food insecurity, which means that they're having to make some very tough choices in terms of their diet. And so if we have children in this country who are experiencing undernourishment, even if it's slight undernourishment, there's a lot of medical research to show that that can have some very significant effects in the long run in terms of children's development, both their cognitive development and their physical development as well. We've been doing a lot of work over the last 10 years, and we found that by far the majority of the population in the United States at some point will experience poverty.
So what does this tell you about America?
Here's what it tells me. If you look at data across other countries, it says that we are doing the worst job in terms of preventing families from falling into poverty. So there's a lot of work that shows that whether you look at children, whether you look at adults, poverty rates in the United States are significantly higher than basically all the other industrialized countries. We in this country choose either to ignore the problem or to blame people for the situation, and therefore to do very little to address the problem. And I think that's extremely counterproductive.
What is it that you would hope we could do to sort of reduce the impact of that economic instability in America?
Well, first of all, one of the things we need to change is our thinking about the issue of poverty. For a long time, we've thought of poverty as affecting somebody else. And what we need to reconsider is that poverty is an issue that affects us all. I've done hundreds of interviews with people in poverty and on welfare, and by far, most people say, I want to work, I'm looking for work. The problem is I'm working at a job that doesn't pay enough, or I don't have a job right now. And so to me, the most effective poverty solution is to provide enough jobs that pay a decent wage for all families in America.
Professor Mark Rank, he's co-author of a major and sobering study on children and food stamps, and it appears in the archives of pediatrics and adolescent medicine. Professor Rank, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome.
Just a reminder, you can listen to our show streamed live on our website, hereandnow.org, or you can download a podcast and take us with you wherever you go. That's hereandnow.org. You can also follow us on Twitter, @hereandnow. After the break, one man's annual search through the bins of Christmas past. You're listening to Here and Now. Welcome back.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire. Jack Frost.
Apologies to fans of the immortal Nat King Cole, but if you love Christmas music and are tired of hearing about those chestnuts for the 100th time this week, fear not. There are people out there who are determined to freshen up those holiday playlists.
Christmas comes, but what's a year? Now it's here, now it's here.
Come and cuddle by the fire in the evening. We'll forget about the snow and rain.
There was a star.
From the labor of love that was the cassette mixtape in the 70s to the effortless click-to-remix in the digital era, a subculture of subterranean DJs make compilations of Christmas music to share with family and friends. John Kalish has a story about one such man, a Jewish New Yorker no less, who just may produce the most eclectic Christmas mix on the planet.
Bill Adler grew up Jewish in Detroit and didn't really have anything to do with Christmas until he got married in the early 1980s and started celebrating the holiday with his wife's family. Adler decided to create his own soundtrack, which he calls the Christmas Jollies.
I just wanted it to be lighthearted and joyful, probably as a way of piercing what I consider the oppressive corniness of the holiday overall. My northern star in this has always been Santa Claus, not Jesus.
Dig that crazy Santa Claus, well, I do believe he will bring some crazy toys, so you better be good this Christmas Eve.
Adler has a long history in the music business, including stints as a publicist, label executive, and pop music critic at the Boston Herald. He worked briefly at Boston's progressive rock powerhouse, WBCN-FM, but he says he was fired for playing a record that wasn't on the playlist. Adler has what musicians refer to as big ears, so he tends to include many genres of popular music on his Christmas Jollies playlists. He's an obsessed collector who doesn't like to repeat tracks from year to year.
I know it's been this Christmas.
I do my best to design each CD as a program, you know, where there's going to be a beginning, middle, and an end. I want to love every individual track. I want to program them or sequence them in such a way that it does create a harmonious whole.
Oh, can't you see it's gonna be a howdy-doody Christmas, a howdy-doody Christmas for all good girls and boys. Can't you see the Christmas tree, its star is shining brightly as Santa Claus so sprightly drops in with all his toys. You will tingle when Kris Kringle plays his jingle bell. It's brighter than the music of a million carousels. Oh, can't you see it's gonna be a howdy-doody Christmas, a very, very merry, merry, very merry howdy-doody Christmas for you.
Chicken crows at midnight on a Christmas day. Rooster crows at midnight on a Christmas day. Children get so happy on a Christmas day. Children get so happy on a Christmas day. Santa Claus coming, and he's coming. Santa Claus coming, and he's coming. Santa Claus coming, and he's coming. Boy, it won't be long.
There's almost always a rap track on the Christmas Jollies, not surprising given that Adler's roots in hip-hop go back to the early days of the Def Jam label, where he came up with the idea for Run DMC to record a Christmas song.
Run so loud and proud, you hear it, it's Christmas time and we got the spirit. Jack Frost chilling, the hawk is out, and that's what Christmas is all about. The time is now.
Adler searches for new material pretty much year-round, picking through piles of old records at flea markets, scouring the bins of Caribbean record stores, and following up leads from friends who know about his quest for undiscovered Christmas music. Most years, the Christmas Jollies has at least one musical shout-out to the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah.
It has a lovely body, its limbs are short and thin, and when it's finally tired, it drops and then I'll win. Oh, dreidel, dreidel.
Dreidel, 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 oh, dreidel, I will play. Adler puts together his Christmas compilation so it plays like an hour-long radio show. Dan Rubin is a columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and a fan of the Christmas Jollies.
It's pretty obvious a ridiculous amount of work goes into these little treasures. They're funny, they rock, they swing, and they all sort of seamlessly flow in each year's Christmas mix. You can tell this guy has spent a lifetime collecting and listening to music, presenting music. This is serious stuff.
Oh, I just wrote a letter. And if my wish comes true, you can bet by Jimmy he'll come down the chimney with a bag full of boop-boop-be-doo. Oh, I want you for Christmas. I'm old enough to know what I want. Oh, I want what I want. I'll get what I want. Christmas morning, baby, I only want you.
I'm watching Christmas on TV and wishing you were here with me. Merry Christmas from 1 million miles away.
I found myself standing in line, waiting on them all to talk to Santa Claus. Standing in line, waiting to see Santa Claus.
Every Christmas Jollies contains at least a couple of season's greetings from pop culture figures, everyone from Yogi Bear to Jack Benny to Julia Child to Johnny Cash.
You know it's not cool to kill on Christmas.
From Krusty the Clown.
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Crazy Kwanzaa.
To the animal trainers Siegfried and Roy.
Our white lions and white tigers join us in wishing you a magical holiday season. With all your dreams coming true.
Adler has friends who tell him that Christmas doesn't really start for them until they get their Christmas Jolly CD. Some won't play the Jollies until Christmas Eve or Christmas morning, when it becomes part of their Christmas ritual.
I know folks who throw their own Christmas parties and play my Christmas Jollies. These friends of mine dub up copies of my CDs and pass them out to their pals too. So the Jollies definitely get a kind of a wider circulation than I intend.
Bill Adler, the man behind the Christmas Jollies playlist. After being distributed on cassette and CD for 25 years, last year the compilation was streamed on the web for the first time.
Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. This is Michael Jackson of the Jackson 5 wishing a happy holiday to all Motown fans.
To see a list of the songs featured in our story about Bill Adler's Christmas Jollies, and to hear Bill's entire playlist for 2009, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Our story was produced by John Kalish. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Please join us again here and now. Thank you.